Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is singer-songwriter Trevor McShane, the alter ego of high-powered entertainment attorney Neville Johnson. But let's start with this. Last week, Universal Music Group and TikTok settled their dispute. If you recall, Universal was trying to get more money for its artists because TikTok really doesn't pay that much. But here's the thing. It turns out that TikTok was actually doing fine during this whole thing, even though UMG artists were not on the platform at all. The UMG artists were the ones that were suffering. And it also turns out that record labels really don't have as much leverage these days as they used to back in the MTV days, for instance. I personally thought that UMG would hold out until the TikTok divestment ban that's going to happen in 6 months or so. And really, this was a ploy for them to say, look, we're getting our artists ready for this. But that wasn't the case, apparently. So just to bring it back up to speed, if you haven't listened to my podcast in a couple of weeks, the House Energy and Commerce Committee had a closed-door meeting with the FBI and the NSA all about TikTok, since it's a Chinese company, how the Chinese government is gaining all its information, and it wasn't good for national security. After that meeting, they unanimously voted that this wasn't a good idea and that TikTok should be banned. And then the bill went out, passed the House, and eventually was attached to the foreign aid bill for Ukraine and Israel and passed there again by a bipartisan majority. The bill was recently signed by President Biden. So that means that TikTok is either going to have to divest or it's going to be banned in the United States. So here's the thing. TikTok has already said that they were not going to give the algorithm to whoever bought the U.S. side of the company. And really, the algorithm is the secret sauce of the whole thing. So if you buy TikTok without the algorithm, you really don't have much. So why should anybody buy it? But there's more to this story because both users and creators have been very frustrated with the TikTok algorithm over the last year or so. And it turns out that many feel that TikTok as a platform kind of peaked last year. Not only that, the platform introduced TikTok Shop this year, and it makes it feel more like QVC. Creators definitely don't like it because they feel that they have to participate or their content is going to get buried. So TikTok might have seen its better days anyway. It turns out that TikTok's biggest market used to be India, but they banned the service in 2020. And what happened was that users just switched to Reels and Shorts. TikTok has also been banned in Montana and by the military in the United States and lots of other countries. Getting back to the UMG and TikTok agreement, the major labels were already seeing that the talent they were getting from the platform couldn't really sustain beyond one hit, and that it was almost impossible to promote their products because the algorithm is so unpredictable. So the only thing left was to get more money from the platform. It looks like UMG didn't get what it wanted, but when the ban happens, it won't matter much anyway. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. The music retailer Sam Ash Music announced last week that it would be closing after 100 years in business. Keep in mind now that Sam Ash is the third largest music retailer in the United States. But the writing was sort of on the wall last year when Sammy Ash, the COO and the driving force behind the company, passed away. Since this is a family-owned business, it seemed like the family really didn't have a will to go on after that. But the writing was already on the wall because musicians had already decided that it was okay to buy things like guitars and amps online without hearing them first. The other thing is help is really hard to get for brick-and-mortar stores. And anyone who's ever gone into a guitar center and had to deal with the kid who was more interested in his band than helping you buy something knows what I'm talking about. Just as an example, Sweetwater's sales engineers go through an intense 6 weeks of training before they ever get on the phone with the client. So the face of music retail has been changing for some time. Some say the change really started with the closing of the famous Manny's Music on Music Row on 48th Street in New York City in 2009. Ironically, the store had been purchased by Sam Ash in 1999. Even though Guitar Center still maintains more than 300 brick-and-mortar stores, the day of the local mom-and-pop music store is quickly passing away right before our eyes. My guest this week is Trevor McShane, the musical alter ego for high-powered entertainment attorney Neville Johnson, who has won more than $350 million for actors, writers, and musicians who have shortchanged their fair share of royalties from both music film studios and record labels. Called one of the most feared litigators in Hollywood by the Los Angeles Times and named a legal legend by the Hollywood Reporter, Neville began his career working for Yoko Ono on matters related to the Beatles catalog. He's gone on to represent many celebrities and or their estates in a variety of contractual, accounting, and intellectual property disputes, including John Lennon, Buddy Holly, Michelle Phillips, Richard Dreyfuss, Rick Nelson, Sylvester Stallone, members of Earth, Wind & Fire, Mitch Ryder, Lloyd Price, and many others. Neville has also written a number of books, including two about the legendary UCLA basketball coach John Wooden, that are available from his Cool Titles publishing company. Neville has released a number of well-regarded releases that have grown his Spotify followers to 100,000 and 150,000 on YouTube. During our interview, Neville and I spoke about keeping his music life as Trevor separate from his legal practice, what he learned from the legendary John Wooden, transitioning to being a litigator, AI copyright, and so much more. I spoke with Neville via Zoom from his office in Beverly Hills. Let's start here. Give me your background and how you got into the music business.
Well, I always loved rock and roll since I was about 7 years old and heard Elvis. And I knew from the time I was 12 or so, I was going to become a lawyer. And when I was about 18 or 19, I figured out that there were lawyers who worked in the music industry. And when I was in law school, that was my focus, was copyright law and anything I could learn about the entertainment business in general and music specifically. And that's all I wanted to do when I got out of law school. And I got a job with a small firm and that did music work. I had been in college at UC Berkeley, and I was the music critic for the Daily Californian at Berkeley, and I was had a radio show, and I picked up a guitar when I was about 20 or so. I really just played in my room all the time. But getting back to your question, how I got into the business, so I that's all my goal was, to do record deals and music publishing deals. And now, all these years later, I'm doing a wide variety of stuff in the entertainment business and law.
Well, I want to talk to you about some attorney things, but first, let's just go to Trevor McShane and how your alter ego came about.
So what happened was I had bought a Yamaha guitar and played that with my friends in college, who taught me a few chords and songs, and then I played it in my, I never really played publicly at all or with others. I wrote a few songs in law school, that one or two came out okay, but it didn't come easy to me writing songs then. And then what happened was I broke my guitar accidentally, and it spent about 6 months or so. Am I going to continue with this or not? And I decided I was, and a friend of mine who worked at a guitar store in the Valley called me and said to come over here now with a certain amount of money. And I got a D35 Martin, which is a fantastic instrument. And I started playing again. Then in 1993, there's a person who goes by the name of Tequila Mockingbird. And I knew, and was in her office one day and picked up a guitar. And she said, you want to play a coffee house? Because she booked coffee houses. So I did, and I went in with Francisco Agobea, who's one of the greatest conga players in world history, now deceased, but played four songs, you know, that I knew well, Buddy Holly and others. And she said, that's all fine, Neville, but you have to do original material. With that, I started to try and write again, and I found that it was easy for me. I can write melody, and I can write lyrics, and I enjoyed it. And I started writing songs. And then I had a friend, client, who I used to play guitar at his house, and he said, I'm going to take you in the studio. So he took me in with two members of the Parliament Funkadelic, Gary Scheider and Bernie Worrell, who were like musical legends, and little old me. I did it, and it was really fun, and I decided I want to do this again. And then I had another client who was a very successful classical violinist. I said, you want to play music with her? She says, I don't jam. But I tell you what you should do. You should do like a string quartet. And I go, what? Anyway, via her, and I put together a viola, a violin, a flute, a guitar, and congas, and bass, and we made an album that over the next 6 years or so, I had a free studio time and did a few gigs, and it came out in the year 2000, but I never promoted it, and I came up with Trevor McShane, which is my stage name, and a phony bio that I used for about 10 years because I didn't want to interfere with my law practice. I want people to think I wasn't serious about being an attorney. So that was in the year 2000. And so I put out that first record and it didn't do, we didn't promote it. So nothing happened. And then a couple of years later, John Barnard and Merrilee Weaver approached me, and I had a relationship with Merrilee in that I was interested in her music, but I used to shop record deals, but I never came to terms with her anyway. Amazingly, they came to me and said, Neville, we think you're really, really talented. We have a studio. We want to produce an album on you. I go, no problem. So that started that. But to bring it up to date, I probably released 3 or 4 albums since then, but not seriously. Never promoted them. And until now. And now I have a manager and a publicist, and we're going for it. And we have my last video put out a couple months ago has 150,000 views, and I sold out my last 5 performances, and I'm having a great time. And that's how I got into the music business. And I'm still a music attorney, only now my job as a music lawyer is basically to sue the record companies.
Yes, I want to go there in a little bit, but first, most musicians start pretty young and are doing gigs, if they so choose, they're doing it, you know, when they're in their teens, and you started a lot later. What was it like in that first gig that you did?
Nervous. I was nervous, but I'm fortunate in that all of the players that I play with are professionals. And look, I don't claim to be any tremendous player. I know majors, minors, and sevenths, and I can get the ball over the plate, and my colleagues like playing music with me. So, and having been in court so much, I'm undaunted at this point. Things don't really go wrong. You make the best of the situation. Look, here's the deal. You got to know your material. And if you have good material, it's fine. So I've honed it over the years.
Well, since your day job is in the entertainment business and in music, representing some great artists, did that ever intimidate you that you were around so many good people?
Well, another reason why I didn't promote the music I was doing over the years is because I don't want to interfere in my legal relationship with people and think I'm some way I'm competitive with them at all. Have I intimidated? Not really. I mean, the only person who, I don't think she really intimidated me is I did a lot of work for Yoko Ono. And she's quite a presence. But no, I mean, I'm not really intimidated by anybody.
Yeah, I would guess that you got to where you are by not being that way.
I intimidate people. That's what I do.
Yeah, okay. Before we get to that, I want to talk about some of your books, because I'm especially fascinated by the John Wooden books that you've written. So how did that come about?
So in 1982... I had basically achieved what I intended to achieve as a lawyer, which was to represent the biggest group of all time, and that was the Beatles. And I was the lawyer for the estate of John Lennon. And I thought, well, I was kind of high on myself, I suppose. But I saw this thing called the Pyramid of Success on a client's wall. I said, what's that? And he goes, that's Pyramid of Success. I said, well, who did that? And he goes, John Wooden. I said, of UCLA, the basketball coach? Yes. And so I became intrigued by it and ended, and I, because I loved it, because it's non-sectarian and it's principled and it's logical and it just makes good common sense. And the philosophy is that success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction and knowing you've made the effort to be your best. And the key ingredients are enthusiasm, hard work, and competitive greatness, which is going after a great and difficult challenge, and others, mortars and building blocks like poise, confidence, ability, skill, friendship, faith, moderation, things like that, teamwork, going after a realistic goal. So I became interested in it, and I said, that's what success is. It's not, you know, any particular accomplishment in business. So I became interested enough that I called up Coach and said, can I come and talk to you? He said, okay. And then I said, I want to interview you. He said, okay. And then I said, I want to write a book with you. And he goes, nope, my wife is ill. I can't. So I wrote three chapters. I sent it out to him. And a month later, it came back redlined by him. And that led me on this odyssey of learning about John Wooden, this amazing man. And it took me 20 years to put it all together. I did several hundred interviews. I went across America. I interviewed his children, his brothers, people he played against in high school, the managers of the teams, sportscasters. And I was a person who had a very limited interest in basketball. And I learned everything there was to know about being a college basketball coach in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and I found it fascinating, and I loved it. And that's how I got involved. And then he has these things that are, I call Woodenisms, which are aphorisms or that he has created, such as failing to prepare is preparing to fail, and it's what you know after you learned it all that counts. The star is the rest of the team, and the softest pillow is a clear conscience. Anyway, we put out a book of those called Woodenisms a few years ago, and those books have both been sold very well.
One of the things I always found fascinating about him was the first day of practice when he taught everybody how to put their socks on and tie their shoes. And it seems so trivial, and yet there was definite intent behind it and good reasoning as well, which I could see how that would be just a sample of what's in the books.
Well, what you're touching upon there is fundamentals. Everything is fundamentals. Mm-hmm. In every business or sport, you got to know what are the moves to make. And that's how he started off each season. It's a true story that people love to mention that overall. But he was very focused and organized, and his drills were never longer than 3 to 5 minutes so that the student athletes, he called them, would not get bored. And I talked to one guy one time who had gone to Harvard Law School and played ball. He says, Neville, you know, there were guys from the ghetto. We didn't hang out necessarily, but I guarantee you, you pick any athlete who played for Coach at any time and you put us on the court, we know exactly what to do. And another thing that I liked about Wooden was he says, I didn't scout the other teams. I just said, you know, we go in and we hit dudes this way, we mow them down. But that's basically what happened. You know, he was just so good and so effective. And then a remarkable man. And that's the other aspect of writing the book. I'm trained to find people's flaws and catch people in lies and things like that. There's basically nothing on Coach Wooden. And he was just a better father, friend, mentor, teacher than he was a basketball coach. And he was the best that ever lived. You know, a really nice guy, a true American. And, you know, so many celebrities and sports heroes, they let us down. Something happens. I won't name names, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it happens every day. There's nothing on Coach.
Since you went so far down the rabbit hole with him, what did you learn that you found made a big difference or made any kind of a difference in your practice or in your
fundamentals
music?
And just keep your head down and go for it. And also, I was involved recently in teaching lawyers. I was on a seminar with a psychiatrist and a judge who has written a book on how to be a happy and successful lawyer, which maybe is an oxymoron to some. But what I mentioned during that Coach Wooden said the most important word in the English language is love, followed by balance. And what I learned was to stop and smell the roses. You only go around once, and you've got to make sure that you're leading a fulfilled life. There was a recent Harvard study that's a book, and it's called The Good Life, I believe. It's gone on for 80 years, and they say, financial security is important. Being in good physical condition is as well. But the single most important thing for having a happy life are good relationships. I learned that's what I learned, amongst many other things. And another thing he says is, don't get too emotional. Be non-emotional. Don't get high after a victory or low after a defeat. And I recognize that in my career, that I can't let it get to me. And another thing is the concept that you're going to make mistakes and fail, and you're not doing a good job unless that's happening, because everybody has to learn from their mistakes and lack of success.
Getting to your career as an attorney, so when you started, correct me if I'm wrong, you were doing normal entertainment attorney duties and then changed somewhere in your career to becoming a litigator against the major film studios, against record labels. What I'm curious about is what led you to that?
Let me tell you that being a music attorney in the late 70s or early 80s was really challenging. It was very competitive. And also, to the extent that my job involved trying to help people advance their careers and their record deals, that was really tough. Everybody wanted to get to the A&R guys. I wasn't of a stage or age anymore where I wanted to be hanging around nightclubs on weeknights, certainly. And I didn't grow up to be an agent or necessarily a schmoozer. Also, unless you had clients that were, really successful, it was the same negotiation over and over. And it was, I was so frustrating because I wasn't able to get what I thought were fair square deals. And then I was doing all that work for Yoko. And then somebody came into my office. My first case was against Earth, Wind, and Fire, Maurice White, who was basically a crook. I've sued him twice. And I found it far more interesting to be doing litigation. You're in a whole new business, meeting new people. Also, it's potentially much more lucrative if you are working on a contingency basis, as I did some of the time. So I just kept on doing that overall. I mean, I still do some transactional work, and I'm happy to do it. But you take what comes your way, I guess. It's one way to look at it. And then we made a lot of important cases over the years. I have, we pioneered bringing class actions against the major record labels and the movie studios for underpayment of royalties and things like that. So it's just, you go where your interests are. I never thought when I started off I would ever set foot in a courtroom. And here I've done 26 jury trials. And I've been recognized for the last 5 years as one of the top 100 lawyers in Los Angeles, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, no kidding. Congratulations. That's very cool.
It's fun and it's interesting. I said when I was about 19, I never want to be bored, and I'm not, because the law is fascinating. And then I have these other interests in music and in writing and if I'm standing at a bus stop and I don't twiddle my thumbs, I put on my phone and I write some verse.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of interesting and ever evolving, Let's talk about copyright for a second, music copyright especially is, and now with AI being such a big component, where do you come down on that? Because there's so many gray areas.
It is all anybody is talking about, both in law and also in society. And it is, to give a bad metaphor, it's the Wild West. It cannot be stopped just the same way as Napster could not be stopped and streaming. It cannot be stopped. I have used it. I tried it on something, ChatGPT, on a script I'm writing. It was helpful. You know, it wasn't amazing, but I got something out of it overall. I have been told that, you know, every producer in town is using it right now and has to, or they feel they're going to be left behind. The Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild, they just had a settlement of the strike. They put limitations on what can be used, but we still don't know. There's a lot of litigation. New York Times has brought litigation, saying, what, you got to take our entire mass, everything we ever created, and it's going to be free to use to some degree? And it is. What I'm saying is that anytime there's a new technology that comes in, it takes 5 or more years for the legislature to settle in and figure it out. And we're in a settling period right now where we're trying to see where the lava is going to stop and flow, et cetera. So I'm sure we'll continue to have great quality entertainment and creations. And I'm sure certain people, many people, author talent will be ripped off to some degree. But you can't stop it, like I said. We're just going to have to take kind of wait and see, and it'll be incremental. It's like the internet right now. You know, the internet, who even heard of the internet 20 years ago, right? Now you can't live without it. And I'll tell you, a big problem with the internet is the couple problems is that if somebody defamed you 20 years ago, it'd go on the back shelves of the microfiche. Now it's up there for life, and it goes around the world. And you cannot sue an internet service provider. They have immunity if somebody else put it up. It's called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It's totally unfair. But Congress has not elected to do anything about it right now. We're seeing movement in the direction, for example, of the internet service providers like Google are being sued for fentanyl because they make it too easy for people to buy and sell it on the internet. And I'm just hoping that someday some laws will be passed like we have for new traditional newspapers, that if somebody says something bad about you, you say, retract this, or I'm going to come after you and sue you. But that doesn't work for Google.
I saw that the Elvis Act in Tennessee passed last week, I think.
Yeah, yeah. The work, and it's called right of publicity, the wrongful use of images of people. And that's an intellectual property asset that people have. If you're a professional model, you don't want people using your visage anywhere that they want overall. And so we've done a lot of work in that area and had trials and done well.
One of the problems with some of the AI text-to-music generators is the fact that they're getting really good. And if you've played with them, you know that to get what you want out of them is very difficult. It takes a long, long time.
Yeah, no, I saw that Tom Cruise fake. It's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's good in the sense of the quality of it. It's not good that there people are able to do it.
Yeah, therein lies the problem.
We live in a world of chaos and disinformation.
So have you played with Suno yet? You know about it.
Suno.
S-U-N-O.
What's that? I've created with a man named Suno in Sweden, who's a prominent songwriter and producer.
Not the same, although it's producing music, and it's producing fantastic music, and it's just text to music.
I haven't heard it.
Suno.
Well, it's amazing, because I heard you can type in a program of, I want to see something, the desert and smoke and trees or whatever, and it will create that then for you. I mean, it's creating video based on text.
Well, Sora is the one I think that all the movie studios are afraid of, and I understand that the company is meeting with the studio heads at the moment to assuage their fears or actually introduce them to it. So we'll see how that shakes out.
Look, the one constant that I think Wooden talks about it too, the one constant in life is change. That's it. Grow with it. As an attorney, I have to stay on top of all the changes that are happening all the time, because I tell my law students, what am I selling but my knowledge? And if I'm not on top of the situation, why are you paying me?
Yeah. I want to come back to AI copyright, because it's kind of interesting, especially from the standpoint that the copyright board has now said that anything that's created 100% AI generated cannot be copywritten. But if a human is involved, then it's possible, but they never say how much human involvement is required.
Well, the copyright office is studying the issue right now and trying to come up with it. And I think there's one country which has said that if a human is manipulating the dials, that there can be some sort of a copyright created. But right now, nobody really knows.
Yeah. All right, Neville, last question. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you? And I think you might have answered this already because of John Wooden, but please do so.
Well, I think that people should understand that they can accomplish, they should try and accomplish what their dreams are as long as they're realistic. I'm able to be an attorney. I'm able to play music professionally. I'm able to write books. I own a book company with my wife. I started off, the Wooden Books are what we own, and I publish and distribute them. And to take the time to enjoy life as much as possible, or I'll leave it even another way. My mother asked me, what would you like on your epitaph? And I said, he was kind. And I think that's fundamentally what life is about, is to be considerate of others. You know, that's what I try and live each day, is to be, you know, do a good job, and be fair and loving, and, you know, you want mental, moral, physical conditions working in the collaboratively with each other at all times. Life goes by so quickly. I was thinking today, there was somebody I knew who was a friend of mine named Galen Horton. He was a great guy. He was a music publisher. And we took on American Express 30 years ago over a $2,000 plane and ended up getting $250,000. And we were going to go out and celebrate. And I couldn't get him on the phone. And finally, I learned that he had leukemia and he passed. And then I was thinking about him last night, and I got to go on and do all these things since then. So Wooden says, make each day your masterpiece. And I have a song called Masterpiece. That's the one that's getting all the views right now. So make the most of it every day is what I've learned, or tried to. And of course, try and achieve success, but you never do, perfection.
You can find out more about Trevor at trevormcshane.com. That's Trevor McShane, TrevorMcShane, all one word, .com. And you can find out more about Neville and his law practice at jjlplaw.com. That's jjlplaw.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.